Shrink Wrap Radio number 431, Mindfulness and Stillness in Mind, with Simon Cole.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is counselor and author Simon Cole, M.A., who has written the book Stillness in Mind, about his approach to mindfulness. He currently runs a retreat center in France. For more information about Simon Cole's background, please consult our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Simon Cole, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Yeah, I'm pleased to have you here. I've been doing a series on mindfulness, and so your book is right on target for that. Your book, Stillness in Mind, which I found a fascinating read. And I'm wondering what prompted you to write this particular book, given your observation that too much has been said and written about mindfulness of late.
Yeah, that's a bit of a conundrum, isn't it? It wasn't prompted by a desire to be out there in the mindfulness book market particularly. It was prompted really from my experience after moving to France and transferring to being a meditation teacher and running a retreat, a counseling retreat as a residential retreat. It was prompted by my experience working with people on a residential basis for whom I produced numerous handouts of one sort or another. And I always felt that I could never give them quite enough, but equally, of course, the other temptation is to try and put in too much in too short a space of time. So that kind of gelled as, well, perhaps I ought to do something which can be used a little bit more long term by people who depart from here, depart from our center, and can be taken away with them. It will contain more than I actually do with them while they're with us. But hopefully, if it's a path that they've started on while they've been with us, then it's a path that they will be inspired to continue with. So that was the inspiration.
Okay, yeah, that's really clear. I can understand why you'd want to do that. And at the end of the interview, we'll come back to your retreat center. I want to find out more about that. I have been jokingly saying that it feels like we're in the midst of a mindfulness bubble.
Yeah.
That may be overstating it, but I had to laugh when I read you observing something almost similar early in the book. You note that mindfulness is on the one hand intellectualized and on the other hand trivialized. Maybe you can expand about those two extremes that you had in mind a bit.
Yeah, okay. I guess the trivialized can be done more easily, and I'm not wanting to sound disparaging of what anybody might have offered in this area. It's more how people might use the various offerings that are available on mobile phones as apps and pads and computers. It's not what is offered as much as what people might be doing with it. So that's the trivializing bit, if you like. And it's not a criticism of any of the providers. It's simply a concern about how it comes over to the person that is using it. In terms of intellectualized, I have a worry. We use words, and words are conveniences. Words are not the actual thing. And so I worry, reading some of the literature, and by no means all of it, but some of the literature, that we seem to be making things overcomplicated because we get hung up on this business of words without realizing that words aren't actually what it is. Mindfulness, if you like, is part of human functionality. And it happens to have been called mindfulness and to have acquired this terminology, and people now are developing the terminology as being more erudite than the base human functionality which gives rise to it.
Okay, great. I get that. And who's the reader that you had in mind? I know that you were thinking of the people who attend your retreat, but I think as you sat down to write the book, you kind of broadened your perspective. And so who's the reader in your mind?
The reader is primarily the user, but I've had a lot of interest, and I'm in fact doing a number of workshops this coming week with practitioners, practitioners being counselors, therapists from various psychologically based orientations. There is more and more interest on the part of the practitioner, at least here, at least on this side of the pond, incorporating mindfulness within the therapy session and doing it in as seamless a way as possible. So it might be offered to the client as something that they could use alongside and complementary to the therapy process. And I always stress this, it's not instead of the therapy process, it's complementary to the therapy process, if that process is going on anyway. So really, it's the end user that the book was written for in terms of how it's aimed, but it is being picked up quite a lot by psychological therapy practitioners.
Yeah, and that's a subject I'm going to want to come back to in just a bit. Now, as we already noted, there's much being written about mindfulness these days. And since we do have to use words here in this interview, what's your own definition of mindfulness?
Well, I start with Jon Kabat-Zinn's definition.
Mm-hmm.
And I've come to compassionate and non-judgmental awareness of the present. And that, for me, is as good a starting point as any.
Okay, good. That's a nice, succinct definition. What is particularly distinctive about your book compared to others out there on mindfulness?
In the mindfulness part, probably it is the way that it is delivered, hopefully. That relates very closely to people's day-to-day experience. I want to add a little bit to Jon Kabat-Zinn's definition, because when I use the word present when I'm delivering a workshop and in the book, I emphasize that it's our present. It's an individual present as opposed to an idea of a present as being what is there outside me in the world around me. No, I am actually in the world. It's my present that we're talking about here. And therefore, it's absolutely individual to the person concerned. And it contains, because our world is our perceptual world, it contains my perception of what is there, which in turn contains all my experience and all my story up to this point in my life, in my existence. I put that little bit of emphasis, I add that little bit to Jon Kabat-Zinn's definition, perhaps. Going on to leading from mindfulness into meditation, I believe that what makes it different from any approach anyway that I have come across is the incorporation of the thinking and insights from these three major figures, which I mention in the book, Rogers, Buber, and Jenlin. And I'm trying there not to direct how people do meditation, but to give a framework for knowing what is happening, if you like. And that's the way I've come to express it. So it's not that I'm putting a framework around what should happen, but I'm offering a framework around knowing what does happen anyway, because of the time we have ourselves going on in our thinking process. And that is there, and that is there in meditation. And I'm trying to, offer a way of knowing that, which allows the meditator to be constructive about their own process.
Now, speaking of your own life, how did mindfulness and meditation come into your own life?
Gradual creeping over a number of years. I mean, I've been working as a counsellor, psychological therapist for some 30 years now. And it started coming in my very early work with an organisation which over here we call the Samaritans, which was a counselling agency for people who were suicidal. And the work there involved something which was very immediate in the moment, and you felt that you were absolutely up with the person that you were talking to. And I suppose that's how it started to creep in, because I started to look at what that actually meant. To begin with, purely from my own experience of it, without going beyond that. Then I started to pick up readings about mindfulness, and I worked with a couple of teachers in the UK leading into meditation. And when I became a qualified counsellor, it developed more and more into being part of my own practice, part of my awareness of how I was, how I could be with the client, and noticing from my own practice how the client's response could be helped by my own awareness of the very moment that we were in our relationship together. And relationship is something that I stress very strongly.
Yes. And it sounds like you make a bit of a distinction between mindfulness and meditation. Perhaps you could tell us what that distinction is.
This is a debated subject, and questions come up on this quite a lot on various forums. I'm not sure that I want to make that much of a distinction, other than to say that I guess mindfulness is the channel into what I have termed the clear space meditation path. It's the way into it, if you like, but there is nothing wrong with it as it stands. It can be used as an intervention against stressful periods in one's day-to-day life. I see it as a tool as opposed to a path, I guess. Maybe that is the best distinction I can make there. I see mindfulness as having the potential of being a tool to be used in day-to-day life, whereas meditation is something that I see as an intentional path to embark upon. If it suits, I'm not prescriptive about this. I don't go quite as far as with Adam Watts saying, well, do meditation if you enjoy it. And I'll go so far with that, but I see it as needing some intentionality in order to be able to be something that contributes to personal growth and personal development.
Okay. And what do you see as the value of cultivating mindfulness in one's life?
Stillness in mind. Sorry, I'm not trivializing the question. I'm quite serious there. Stillness in mind, I think, is the value of cultivating it. So then I guess we come back to, well, what do you actually mean by stillness in mind? What I mean by stillness in mind is the ability to be with whatever is around and be okay with it, because you are okay with yourself as well. So it offers the release which comes from allowing what is around, whether that be other people, situations or circumstances. It offers that release of being able to allow, because what is there is simply there, and it doesn't need to be any more than simply there.
And what about in psychotherapy? What do you see as the value of cultivating mindfulness in the context of psychotherapy?
In the context of psychotherapy, if it is introduced, then it allows, if it's picked up by the client, obviously, it allows an opening of the client beyond the straitjacket or the tunnel vision which they might, perhaps aware, perhaps unaware, they might feel themselves in. Part of the initial stages of working with a client in psychotherapy is to find a way to help the client to open up the field that they're allowing to be their lives. Because most clients come having imprisoned themselves behind bars of their own making. And to be able to be the other side of those bars and open up to the possibility of life being about living and the possibility of living always being there. I find it helps that way.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. Now, earlier you mentioned Rogers, Gendland, and Buber as contributing to the way that you conceive of psychotherapy, I gather, and the way you think about mindfulness. Maybe you can say a little bit about what each one contributes to that.
Yes. They're certainly people, three of them, the people that I consider very significant in terms of my own philosophy and my own approach. I start, and I still consider myself fundamentally a person-centered counselor for Carl Rogers. And from Rogers' approach to counseling, I take empathy. Now, lots and lots of approaches and people talk about empathy. Rogers makes it a fundamental part of the core conditions which he says are necessary for the therapeutic relationship between the counsellor, the therapist, and the client. And he sees the nature of the therapeutic relationship to be the primary therapeutic vehicle, not any particular technique. Simply the nature of the therapeutic relationship, of which empathy is the fundamental part. Empathy allows the client to feel validated, and that is the most significant aspect of this. Because when we come to developing mindfulness into the meditation approach that I offer, the ability to validate oneself within that. So whatever comes up is a part of me, and I need to find a way of allowing it to be a part of me, and to be able to be empathic with myself is an aspect of being able to validate myself and whatever it is that I find that is arising in the meditation process. Martin Buber, who is known mostly by his iconic work I and Thou, although he was a very prolific writer. Martin Buber I look to for his insights into the process of human relating. Martin Buber said, all real living is meeting. And that is absolutely fundamental to the process of being able to be with yourself in a process of meditation in a therapy, in an intentionally therapeutic way. Mm-hmm. All real living is meeting, from which he develops the concept of ourselves holding ourselves as I in two different ways. We can think of ourselves as I in relation to most of the stuff that goes on around us, of which we make an object. So I look at somebody and I can describe them and I know them, or I make in my mind an image of something or some person, and in that sense I'm objectifying what is outside me. But Buber said we can also feel ourselves in a different way, and this is what he described as I thou. I can feel myself as simply a presence alongside another presence. I don't have to objectify the person that I'm with. I can allow them to be themselves and be myself along with it. And that way we can achieve a flow in our relating with the other person. That is very important also in the way that I develop it in meditation, because it is important that we allow ourselves to keep flowing. If we look at something objectively, as soon, if you like, come back to this business about words, words being conveniences, as soon as we give something a name, we have actually fixed it. We have fixed it at a point, and if we fix something at a point, we stop it flowing.
Mm-hmm.
If we work as an I-thou relationship, then we are allowing that life, that living to flow alongside our living. And that is fundamental to the meditation process, being able to have a flow which generates steps, generates a process which is therapeutic and also helps with our own personal growth and development. Eugene Gendlin, coming to the third one, Eugene Gendlin, best known for his original work, which was a very small work called Focusing, and he developed the approach of focusing, and there are focusing groups all over, and they're not necessarily connected specifically to therapy or therapists. Focusing is about being able to use the edge of awareness, stuff that is around for us, somewhere held physically as well as mentally in us, which we don't quite know, but yet we have an image of. It's a bit like if you're coming down a mountain and you've been in clouds up the mountain completely, and then you get to a point where you can just see what's below you. The clouds are shifting around and you get part of an image of something and part of an image of something else until it finally comes into clarity. If you like that, that could be a picture for how focusing works. And so that's what I take from Gendlin.
Okay, well, that's a lovely description. I particularly like the way you expanded on Buber's work, and I can't resist a little name dropping, namely that I got to have dinner with Carl Rogers once, and also got to meet Eugene Gendlin, who I had long been an admirer of. So I also value the contributions of these people.
So does my description fit with how you feel in yourself?
Yes. Yeah, very much so.
Okay.
And I think often Rogers is oversimplified. People don't really understand the depth and subtlety of what he did.
I believe that too.
Yes. Yeah,
I believe that. I think Rogers' approach was very, very challenging for the counselor, for the therapist, because it makes the counselor go in there without any techniques or tricks to fall back on. You haven't got anything. All you have is yourself. And that was quite a breakthrough when he expanded on that and developed it.
Yes, yes. Particularly at the time that he was doing that, the other two major approaches being behaviorism and psychoanalysis, which were both very technique-oriented. So this was almost like, it was shockingly
yes.
different.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And I'd never thought to think about Rogers in the context of meditation or mindfulness, but actually, as you've described it and as I think about it, I can really see that connection there.
I believe so. I don't know whether Rogers indulged in meditation at all, but I believe it has that connection. It seems to draw itself in very naturally.
Yeah, well, as you point out, there is mindfulness in day-to-day life, and that he certainly seemed a person who had that kind of mindfulness, though maybe not a practice of meditation or the discipline of mindfulness, but it was part of who he was and how he practiced.
Yeah.
Now, you write that the first step in mindfulness is not to get distracted. Well, what can you tell us about the role of distraction in our lives these days?
Yeah, what can't you say? Can I just go back a, a, a little bit before your question. I write, at least when I'm doing this as a workshop and a seminar, the point I start with really is a question to the group. So what does it take for you to be satisfied? Mm-hmm. And then I move into distraction, because we distract ourselves by not being satisfied. And this really is coming to your question, I think.
Okay.
We are so easily not satisfied. We seem to need, and it partly is human process, we seem to need ever more to satisfy ourselves. And yet, if we think about it, we can never be satisfied if that is what we're doing. If in order to be satisfied we need to more, then we will never be. It's self-defeating. And so I move from what does it take to satisfy you to the role of being distracted in mindfulness. If we can allow ourselves to simply let the moment be what it is, but that means that we also have to allow ourselves to be what we are, because we are coming to the moment. It's not the moment that's out there somewhere or other disconnected for us, and we've got to go and join it and be with it and be fully aware of it. That would be treating mindfulness as the objective in the same way as Buber talks about I-it. That would be as ourselves taking an I-it stance to mindfulness. But yet that doesn't feel quite right, because mindfulness is about living. Mindfulness has to be about flow. We have to be in an I-thou relationship with mindfulness, which means that we have got to be allowing what is there to be alongside us, and allowing ourselves to be alongside it. That it means that we have to be able to draw ourselves away from what is unnecessary in the moment. And if we take any moment in our lives and ask, well, what is actually necessary in this moment in order for it to be fulfilling for me? And usually we can dispense with something like 95% of what we think is going on, because we're creating that need in our head.
Well, what do you say to people who say, well, there are just so many distractions in my life, I don't have time for this, you know, there's the internet, there's iPhones, there are movies, there's popular culture, there's email, all of this stuff tugging at my awareness all the time.
Yeah, but hold on, who's being distracted? Where's the life? It's your life. We allow it. We allow ourselves to be distracted. It's not that the internet is saying with some distant cyber voice, hey there, pay attention to this, or hey there, you've got to answer my email now. Or we allow ourselves to be distracted.
Mm-hmm.
We can find a place for something. But I'm not against the internet, not against emails or any of sort of technology of the modern age. But we can allow ourselves to say, well, this is what I choose at this moment, and this is what I choose at this moment. Unless we do make a choice, then we are not fully living.
Okay. Now, you say the second step is not to anticipate. What can you tell us about that?
If we anticipate, we take ourselves out of the moment. If we anticipate by wanting something more, something bigger, something sexier, whatever, we take ourselves away from the enjoyment of this particular moment. The exercise which is in the book, but I actually do as a workshop, I actually take round and give everybody a chocolate.
And I bet they like that.
Yeah, that's right. And I get them to eat the chocolate without saying any more. And then ask them about that experience of eating the chocolate, and whether they detected any distraction from, oh gosh, I shouldn't do this because it's not good for me, and I'm not supposed to have sweet stuff, or oh, I wonder if he's got another one. And they are immediately taking themselves out of the moment, and invariably, people can appreciate that if they were able to allow themselves simply to savor what they have in that one chocolate that they can taste, then actually their enjoyment of the moment is far more than if they were anticipating, perhaps another one, or perhaps I could get a bigger one, or I wonder what comes next. And immediately we do that, we take part of our mind away from simply acknowledging the savoring of this particular moment. And it doesn't matter, it doesn't have to be a chocolate, it can be anything you like.
Okay. Now, you've developed something you call the clear space meditation path. Is this different than mindfulness, or is this more of an instructional guideline, let's say?
I would say it's probably more of an instructional guideline. What I found with clients after I started introducing people to a meditation path, and it's what inevitably happens. Everybody gets interrupted by their thoughts. It's what people think of as the problem they have with meditation, as if it's a problem unique to them. And of course, it isn't a problem unique to them. Our minds are working all the time. What I found and what this developed from was a need to have some sort of figure of a space to come back to in the meditation process, intentionally to an extent, but it's almost like something to fall back on in the meditation process, because inevitably, whether you're using the framework that I'm suggesting or others, we get interrupted. We get interrupted and we're not quite sure where we are, and I've got lost. All right. Don't worry about the getting lost. You can simply fall back to what I began to see as and term as a clear space. That might or might not have a picture. For me, it doesn't particularly have a picture. For some people, it does, and that helps. For me, it is a picture, if there is one, is, if you like, a flat space. I did a retreat a few years ago in the Sahara, and that contributed a lot to how I felt meditation. I had a kind of shift for me from that. So it might contain a flat space, but more for me now, it contains my breathing there, almost like an old friend there waiting for me. And I find that, and clients of mine have found that it is just something that they can sink back on as a space which is clear, uncluttered by thoughts, and where they can simply abide, where they can simply wait, and if another process starts to arise that is immediate, as opposed to thoughts which aren't immediate, if another process starts to arise, then they can let it be there and abide with it, and the process that I have outlined in the book can begin again.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just mentioned breathing, and you write about different kinds of breathing over the course of meditation, and I think you discussed maybe four different kinds of breathing. Maybe you can take us through those.
Yeah. The breathing that I talk about as the channel into meditation is very simple, and I don't claim any exclusivity for this at all. I start people with three long breaths. That's diaphragm breaths, not chest breaths. Three long breaths, gradually letting the rate of breathing subside to a normal level, which in all probability would be slightly slower than their normal level, but allowing it to subside to what feels like a normal level. A bit like if you could feel yourself just coming down a gentle slope into a flat space below, that sort of sense. But different patterns of breathing can have different effects, physically, physiologically. For instance, one of my breathing suggestions is to allow the breath to come in, almost to float in, and then as you breathe out, intentionally breathe out in the sense of leaning into your breath. And that can develop into a feeling of stroking the tension from muscles as you breathe out. And I in another context, I might use breathing, which pauses very slightly at the end of the in-breath and at the end of the out-breath, with the sense of a circularity, so that there develops a circularity which has a feeling of a continuity, and I find that useful for people when they say that the process seems to be very fragmented and that nothing seems to sort of smooth out when they're meditating. That's another. I don't claim any exclusivity for these, and I'm sure other people use them and call them various different terms. These are the ones that I have found useful to offer people to aid their process of meditation.
Okay, you also write about developing a felt sense, and in that I definitely hear the voice of Eugene Gendlin. But
yes.
I'm not quite sure that I got the role of this felt sense in meditation.
Okay. When I talk about felt sense, and this is slightly different from Gendlin, I'm always talking about the felt sense of me and when I offer it to people as something to use within meditation, I am offering it in the context of being able to sit alongside as an observer, as an empathic companion, and you are sitting alongside the felt sense, so of you and. Now that you and could be you and another person, or it could be you and an aspect of yourself. So, for instance, that if we were to say that you are aware of the clear space which you have found at the end of your breathing channel into your meditation sitting, and in the clear space something arises, you know it's not thought, it's not a rehearsing thought, replaying or fantasizing, it's something more immediate than that. It contains a thought element, and it will have a word come to it. Gendlin, if you recall, Gendlin talks about giving a word to your felt sense, and then shuttling backwards and forwards to see if that really does describe all of it, see if that word is really what it's about. Okay, in a similar sort of way, we may have a felt sense arise from within our clear space, and let us say the felt sense is something connected with my feeling nervous in some situations. So, and it wouldn't necessarily have a situation attached to it. It's the sense of me being nervous. So in using this in meditation, I would suggest that the felt sense is that me and my nervousness, and I can sit alongside as an empathic companion, I can sit alongside me and my nervousness. If you like, I'm kind of in two places, but what I'm doing is validating myself in my sense of being a person who is nervous in some situations. And what seems to happen there is that something else develops, a kind of conversation. There's a chapter in the book, there's an actual real example in the book from one of my clients, with permission, obviously, a kind of conversation or fragments of a conversation develop which shifts how the person is, how the person feels about themselves. And this persists after they come out of their meditation sitting. And this is the way in which I use felt sense. It allows what Gendlin would describe as a change step. That's Gendlin's terminology, but I'm incorporating it in a meditation process which contains both Roger's empathy and also Buber's sense of I-thou. I'm not making an object of my me and my nervousness. I am allowing it, in Buber's sense, I am allowing it to be a presence alongside my presence in my meditation sitting.
Okay. Now, you also advise, instead of a person just kind of jumping up after they're done meditating, you advise contemplation after meditation. Maybe you can say a little bit about that.
Just for a few moments, and this also really comes from Zenden. Zenden says that you should welcome what comes. Even if you don't completely understand it, if there has been a change step, if you recognize a change step in Zenden's terminology, welcome what comes, whatever it is, however little it is, however insignificant it might appear to be. It's that feeling that I try to pick up, and I suggest that just sit for a few moments, maybe a couple of minutes, maybe as long as 5 minutes, but it doesn't have to be anything like. And really what you're doing is simply welcoming the process itself, appreciating the process itself for whatever it has been. If you don't completely follow what has happened, never mind. It is simply something that has happened, and you can welcome that and be with it and appreciate it. That's what I mean by the pause after meditation.
Okay, and what's your advice to those who have difficulty establishing a regular meditation practice?
Perseverance. If you believe in it and if you want to do it, then persevere with it. I generally suggest to people when they're starting off when they come to us on a residential basis, it's something you've got to be prepared to do without any sort of decision-making process. You say to yourself, right, for 2 weeks, I'm simply going to do it. I've decided that it could be a benefit to me. I want to get far enough to be able to see whether I'm going to feel a benefit from this. And then the only thing you can do is simply do it, possibly set aside a specific time. I do believe that setting aside a specific time is good. Set aside a specific time and simply say, that time each day for the next 2 weeks, I'm going to do it. At the end of 2 weeks, this is the deal you make with yourself. At the end of the 2 weeks, if I can't say that I've got anything out of this at all, then I'll just stop it. So you're kind of doing a deal with yourself at the beginning. But generally speaking, if you do it like that for 2 weeks, you will find that if you then miss, you will know you've missed, if you see what I mean. So in other words, if you don't do it for 1 day or 2 days, you will realize that you're missing something.
Okay. Now you have a chapter titled Being Ourselves and Visiting Our Pain, in which you go through a number of difficult emotions that might arise during meditation. Maybe you can take us through some of that.
Yeah, this seemed quite important. What I wanted people to feel as their experience, if they were to work through this book, is something akin to the experience they would feel they had got if they'd come and stayed with us for a week or for 2 weeks. I put in theme meditation, for instance, but also I wanted a chapter which gave a mindfulness slant on common problems, common psychological problems, just issues that we get day to day. And that's what this chapter is intended to offer. And so I start with something which we all experience from time to time. I'd start with disappointment and how we might look at disappointment in terms of mindfulness, and how we might approach it in terms of mindfulness. So if you like, it seeks to bring the awareness into the present and discarding the baggage and the history which goes with various issues. So an attitude to disappointment might be no more than, if I can do it, I will do it. If I don't manage it, it was beyond me. That sort of very present and very immediate attitude to the issue that is coming up. Sadness likewise. Sadness asks us to allow the moment to be sufficient. Into sadness we bring the history of the object of our sadness, but yet we can allow our sadness to simply be our sadness, and this is how it is. It is complete and it's sufficient in itself. And if it's complete, if something is complete, if we bring only what's immediate, in the moment, then it is finished. And tomorrow's joy can be tomorrow's joy, and maybe there will be some sadness tomorrow as well, but it doesn't have to owe anything to today. We are able, with mindfulness, to complete where we are in many of the issues that confront us day to day. And so I've looked through remorse as well, and guilt, and also we come to stress, which is very significant for many people in their day-to-day lives. Stress, likewise, and anxiety, we can look at from a mindfulness aspect. We can clear away the narrative which goes with many of the psychological difficulties that hit us. We can clear away the narrative and bring us into simply what is around in the moment and what is still with us in the moment, and be with that without bringing in the narrative into the present. Because the present, after all, is all there is. We are living in the present. We're not living in the narrative of the past. We have to live in the present moment. It's the only place we have.
Now, you have a discussion on the use of mantras, and the examples that you gave look much like what I might call affirmations. Is there a difference between the two?
No, I guess there isn't. Affirmation is an aspect of the mantras that I give as examples. I try to combine the sort of classic idea of mantra as something holding and repetitive, but not necessarily to be understood for itself. So when I talk about mantras, just to take one of my examples, for instance, is "Sing softly, my soul." And I suggest that you read the mantra and you start with the mantra, but then in the process of meditation, you let go of the "sing" and the "my," and what you're left with is something which can almost become a note: softly, soul, and that becomes the mantra without saying the words to yourself. You go from the written word into a sense of almost the words as a note, and let that be what is resonating with you. Letting go, letting free, goes to go free, go free.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are other topics we could take up from the book, but I don't want to short-circuit people actually purchasing your book to get the full story. Quite a few therapists and therapists in training will listen to this interview. What's your advice on the value of mindfulness as a therapeutic tool and how to introduce it into the therapeutic relationship?
A sensitivity, first of all. Not everybody is open, and certainly not everybody is open immediately, to being offered a tool which might be very foreign to their own way of encountering their world. I think the most important thing is for the therapist to ensure that they have a sense of their own being in the moment, and when it's appropriate to offer this to the client. Empathy and congruence are very important, and sometimes the therapist can actually draw the client into an awareness of their own contribution, the therapist's own contribution to the relationship, and offer the client who is finding difficulty with exploring their own emotions a way to simply be with their emotions. And this is the empathic companion bit coming in again, a way to be with their own emotions, to allow their anxiety, because most clients have anxiety in the process, at least at the beginning, to allow their anxiety to subside by giving them the breathing channel to help their anxiety to subside. It's a very common thing with the helper in all sorts of situations. Keep breathing. Yes, okay, but we can do a little bit more than that. We can offer a more structured breathing channel, and then as that anxiety and tension subsides, we can offer the client observations as to where they are now and what else might open up from where they are. Because the beginning of the therapy process is so much about the client opening up and being able to see more. Being able to see more simply because there is less tension in their body, and so there will be less tension in their mind.
Now, I noticed that you haven't made any references to Buddhism in our conversation here, and I'm thinking that maybe in psychotherapy you also would not make those references to Buddhism. Can you say something about that?
I wouldn't personally. I think there are in the book a couple of references, but they're not technical type of references to Buddhism at all. I would not, in psychotherapy, unless the client wanted to ask the question, or unless the client showed an interest in that, and I am not a Buddhist, and I wouldn't presume to comment from that angle.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that there are some people, I suspect quite a lot of people, who may be able to use meditation constructively for themselves, who might be slightly put off by what they believe is the religious aspect of meditation, because it's so much connected, both mindfulness and meditation, so much connected with Buddhism. Now, okay, religion and Buddhism, we can have all sorts of arguments about that, and I would discount that as an idea in the client's mind if they offered it. But I think there are many people who, if there weren't any sort of what they might consider religious slant to a practice, would be more open to using it or trying it and seeing whether it could help them, whether it was beneficial to them.
Are there certain kinds of psychological issues for which it would be particularly recommended, mindfulness, that is?
I would certainly consider it as a complementary therapy to somebody who is suffering severe stress. Beyond that, I don't think so particularly. I think it can benefit virtually anyone, anywhere.
Just to test your religion on that a little bit, are there certain kinds of clients or issues where it might be contraindicated?
There has been some suggestion, some discussion as to whether with certain types of psychotic conditions it can actually prompt, and I'm talking about meditation generally here, it can actually prompt a serious episode, possibly a psychotic episode. The jury is out. It is not known. There is a suggestion that there might be an effect, an adverse effect, from somebody who had an acknowledged psychotic condition.
Have you experienced anything like that? Where
I have not at all. No, mm-hmm. I have
okay.
not at all.
Well, let's talk.
But that is not me saying it isn't there. I'm
sure.
Simply saying I have not experienced it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your retreat center in France. What can you tell us about that, and why did you go to France?
Why did you go to France? I went to France because I happened to see a suitable property, and I wasn't looking for it. I was looking for a shack halfway up the mountains to go walking from, because we're in the foothills of the Pyrenees Mountains, and I ended up with a property which... It might have been in my mind for a number of years. I had long thought that I would like to be able to offer people a therapeutic experience, a healing experience, if you like, not dissimilar to the thinking that went behind R.D. Lang's Philadelphia project in London in the 1950s. The idea that by and large, we can heal ourselves if we are given the right environment and the right time. And that had been an idea sort of floating around my mind for a number of years, never having known how it might transpire, how that would be possible, or even really having a picture. But then when I saw this property, it fitted this idea which had been floating around in my mind, and it just clicked, basically. And so we bought this property, or I signed up the initial act for this property then, and we have since developed it, and we've been there 8 years now. And primarily we offer therapeutic retreats, both for individuals and couples, and a few group retreats as well.
Yeah, I was wondering about the program. Is there always sort of some group sort of program, or do some people come and just to be in nature and to get one-on-one therapy?
More people do that. We thought that originally it was going to be primarily for groups, and we run 3 or 4 groups a year for next year. No, 5 next year, I think. And we thought that was going to be the call that most people would make on it. What we actually found is that when people were coming to what we build, if you like, as group retreats, what they had in mind that they were coming to was residential counselling. And so we shifted our view slightly, and we take more people now for individual or couple residential counselling than we do on group retreats. And so that has been our prime function for the last few years. Now next year we're running 5 group retreats, and they are around offering 3 group retreats to people who want to use stillness and mind, and also a couple of group retreats for therapists who want to develop as part of their practice.
Uh-huh. How do people find out about you?
Internet, basically. Do a bit of advertising, but not that much. We're in the Good Retreat Guide and 1 or 2 other guides. And people trawl around and eventually like them. My main site has been around for quite a time, so we're relatively high in the search listings. So that helps.
What is the URL for that site?
Sorry, what is?
What's the web address for that site?
Right, sorry. Life counseling, there's a hyphen there, life-counseling.co.uk.
Well, we probably should wrap it up here, and I'm wondering if there are any final thoughts that you'd like to leave our listeners with.
$64 question there. I guess. I, having lived in France for 8 years, I like the French way of saying wait. People know the French for to wait as attendre, but actually what you say more often than not is patienter, which effectively is be patient. Uh-huh. And I guess that is the thought. Be patient. Be persistent, yes, that's good, but be patient, be gentle with yourself, and things will change. Everything changes.
Okay, well, that's a wonderful thought to close with. Simon Cole, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much. Thank you for giving me the space.
Okay, well, I'm here with my Shrink Wrap Radio intern, Eric Hanley, and so a listener brought to my attention the fact that I had not been introducing Eric each time that we have a conversation after one of my interviews. So that's who I'm having this conversation with. Hi, Eric.
Hey, great to be back, David.
Yeah, and I should point out that normally you and I are sitting opposite one another when we're having this conversation after an interview, but it's now, because of things we had to do today, it is now in the evening, many hours after we conducted our interview with Simon Cole, and we're talking over Skype, but this will give us a little chance to reflect on the interview that we just had, or not just had, but had some hours ago. And so I'm wondering what stands out for you.
Well, it has been a pretty good period to integrate and reflect on the conversation earlier today. And I guess what stands out to me is his take on mindfulness. You know, it is different from the allegory and all of the words and, you know, what we hear about mindfulness today, because it is such a hot topic. So
yeah,
it was refreshing to me to hear someone who could really get through to the essence of what mindfulness actually is and what it is in practice.
Yeah, and the thing that impressed me was that he was able to do that without, I want to say mumbo jumbo, and I shouldn't, I really shouldn't, but since he pointed out that he is in fact not a Buddhist, doesn't consider himself a Buddhist, and most of the people that I interview about mindfulness do acknowledge that they're pretty much allied with the Buddhist tradition. So I found it refreshing that he kind of had to go an extra mile, I think, to really bring it down to a kind of an everyday sort of experience and conversation.
Right, he did. He did. And what also came to mind was, jumping back a couple of episodes, Dr. Nima Gorbani,
yes.
He defined mindfulness as a pre-reflective state of awareness, which I thought was just a fantastic definition, because it really gets through the essence of what it means to be fully present. You know, there isn't that reflectiveness that goes on. And Simon Cole today talked about that period of integration after an episode, or a period of meditation where you can reflect back and think about the actual experience. So, a lot of great stuff came up today.
Yeah, that was one of the elements that I particularly liked about his approach as well, was the idea of reflection after meditation, because I think often during meditation there are insights that one has, and if you take time to kind of sit with those insights, or perhaps information about personal issues or relationship issues or so on, or even ideas for new projects and so on, even though you're sitting in a state of supposedly more or less empty-mindedness, still those things do arise, and I think that they can contain important directions and implications. Now, I'm not sure if that's what he was talking about or not.
Right.
Anything else come to mind?
Actually, what kind of surprised me as I was standing there listening and, to the interview, was to hear about your personal experience with Carl Rogers.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes
I didn't know before.
Right. Sometimes it's hard for me to avoid the name dropping because I feel so privileged to have had the opportunities that I have had to interview so many seminal figures and to meet some. And, of course, at the time that I met Carl Rogers, this was way before I started doing this podcast interviewing, and it just so happened that he had come up to a kind of freestanding graduate school at the time that one of our graduates had started, and I think was giving a presentation to graduate students, and it turned out that I had a chance to sit with him, I think alone, as I recall, I think it was just me and him over dinner, and to be able to chat. And that was meaningful for me because, I had been a longtime admirer of his work and had taught courses on introduction to counseling for many, many years. And one of the texts that I used was really based on his work. So, yeah, that was... it was nice to both to have that experience and to be able to mention that. And then Eugene Genland, who I also mentioned, I knew about him long before he brought out his book talking about focusing. And I was a big admirer of Eugene Genland because there was the only American Psychological Association journal that I was interested in was a journal called Psychotherapy, I think, Theory, Research, and Practice. And it was such an interesting journal because it was much more eclectic than other APA journals at that time and really open to a diversity of topics and approaches and so on. And in fact, I had been able to publish an article in that journal. And so I was an admirer of him. He was the editor of the journal, if I didn't already say that. And so, And then he visited us at Sonoma State University once or twice. Somebody invited him, and so I had a chance to meet him and to hear him speak a bit. And then later, he brought out this book called Focusing, and I was very impressed by that and, you know, tried to integrate that into my own therapeutic work at the time.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Well, having been personally acquainted with these I guess you might call them classic psychologists. Do you feel that they'd be open to, you know, mindfulness practices that we see here today?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think both of those two people that we're talking about, Rogers and Gendlin, would find, you know, all of this interest in mindfulness very congruent with their own outlook and practices. So, yeah, I think so.
Great.
So maybe that's enough for now. I always like to keep our little chats relatively short because I've been doing hour-long interviews, and so then I don't want the whole thing, you know, to be too long for fear that we would lose listeners. But I really appreciate this opportunity to kind of reflect with you after the interview, and thank you for standing by and supporting me in this.
Oh, as do I. What a privilege. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I know that you're not available this next week, so you won't be on the next one, but on some, and I don't remember what comes after that right now, but I'll talk to you again soon in this context, okay?
Looking forward to it.
Okay. Bye.
Here's a little mindfulness exercise for you listeners of Shrink Wrap Radio. Whilst listening to an episode of Shrink Wrap Radio, when something really grabs you, and something will, write it down. Then, do a little mindfulness exercise. You can do the usual body scanning thing to relax yourself. Observe thoughts coming into and letting them go out of your head, etc. Then, when you feel calm, take a look at each of those things that grabbed you, individually. Read one, close your eyes, and let thoughts about that point come in and out of your mind. You'll find that there's a reason why those things grabbed you enough to write them down, and exploring them in this way can reveal insights you might not have been expecting. Then, when you've finished your list, you'll be in the ideal, appreciative frame of mind to go onto the Shrink Wrap Radio website and click on that big round support Shrink Wrap Radio button. After all, gratitude will only bring greater joy to yourself and help maintain the flow of mind food for further personal development. It is totally selfish, really.
Thank you, Simon Huggins, for that call to action. And I must say, synchronicity strikes again because it perfectly matches our mindfulness interview today. Thanks to all of you who are lending financial support to my efforts here at Shrink Wrap Radio. And in that vein, I'd like to thank the two donors who've stepped up since the last podcast. And they are Cynthia Pereira Lira, sorry for butchering your name, Cynthia, and Alexandra Stowe Graylin Frey, or it might be Fry. So that's two butcherings. Please know your support means so much to me. Speaking of support, I've just signed up as an affiliate for the Apple iTunes Store. I think it's the case that you can use iTunes even if you're a Windows computer user. At any rate, Shrink Wrap Radio will make a 7% commission on any music tracks or albums you purchase when you click on the little black and white iTunes banner in our left-hand sidebar that says Download in iTunes. I believe you can use this to purchase other products in the iTunes store as well, such as iPhone apps and iBooks. This is so new that I really hope you can help me kick the tires by ordering something, even if it's just one song, and letting me know if it worked okay for you. For example, I'm not sure if it will work for folks outside the U.S. or not. So give it a try, if you would be so kind, and let me know what happened for you. Finally, you know there's an Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar, right? Do you know you can use that to order not just books, but anything at Amazon? I know many of you probably use Amazon regularly to purchase all sorts of things. We buy coffee there, keep ourselves stocked in the Kona coffee that my wife prefers. Also, the season of giving is hard upon us, and many of you will probably purchase some of those gifts on Amazon. If you'll just remember to use the search tool in our widget, it will automatically add our affiliate code, and Shrink Wrap Radio will get a small percentage of the purchase. And it's another way that you can help to support us.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Thank you, Heather Gout. It's been some time since I've used that little clip, and I hope you're still out there and listening. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. I'll read just two. First, we hear from Ladan in Iran, who writes, "Hi, Dr. David. This is Ladan. I am a student in general psychology in the psychology, it says in the Psych M degree, and I'm assuming that might be a master's program. And Ladan says, I wanted to say you're a great psychologist, and I love to listen to all your podcasts. It's wonderful to load them and listen to the scientist's view of all those things. I found this radio web a few months ago, and I thought that it might be cold, boring psychology arguments. But when I started to listen in the kitchen while I'm cooking or cleaning, I found the interviews so interesting with your nice voice. Frankly, your guests have a great ideas and opinions on their subjects. The most exciting thing for me is I can understand almost all the words in the interviews because my English is not perfect. Anyway, I just wanted to say, in this corner of the world, Iran, I'm listening to you and enjoy it so much, and surely I will use these ideas in my courses at the university. Best regards." And that's from Ladan. And Ladan, it's so wonderful to hear from you in that corner of the world. And I'm wondering if you might be one of Professor Nima Gorbani's students there at the University of Tehran, who I interviewed recently. And if you are, I'm sure you will have enjoyed hearing that. I must say that your English is much better than my Persian, and it's wonderful having friends there in Iran. Next, we hear from Nick, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm a new psychology student and have just stumbled upon your podcast. I've listened to number 355, Current Developments in Positive Psychology, which was so informative and gave me exciting insights and mind-boggling forking thoughts on the direction of my education into the field, and number 394, The Benefits of Playing Video Games, which is a very dear subject for me and had me bouncing in my seat trying to absorb the many tidbits of fascinating, hopeful, and inspirational research presented by Dr. Gronick. What a find! You asked questions that I was burning to know the answers to, along with some that I would never have thought to have asked, and am so grateful for, and I'm finding that your thoughtful approach to these interviews is opening my eyes to possibilities for my development and future career that I cannot wait to share with my friends and family. If there's still a need, I would love to use some of my free time to transcribe a show for your website. It would be so worthwhile, and I love the idea of being a contributing element for this incredibly valuable enterprise. Just let me know which one I can work on or how to direct my own selection so that it doesn't overlap with the work of others. I look forward to hearing from you." At the end of number 394, you said that you had been under the weather for a couple of weeks. I hope that you're well. Thanks so much. And that's from Nick Munson, in parentheses, hopeful future PhD. Well, Nick, thank you so much for writing. And thanks for asking after my health. Actually, I had forgotten even about being under the weather, which is what happens when we get better. Once it's gone, it's out of mind. And so I'm feeling very well right now. And so that others will know, I did go ahead and invite Nick to do a transcript of number 394, The Benefits of Playing Video Games, since it had not been transcribed and since it was so near and dear to Nick's heart. So, Nick, it's wonderful to have you in the Shrink Wrap Radio community, and you'll find lots here to nourish you. So with that, we better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to Simon Cole for sharing his wisdom on mindfulness. And my next guest will be Dr. Mark Horowitz, a family therapist and organizational consultant and coach, and we'll be discussing his book, The Dance of We, The Mindful Use of Love and Power in Human Systems. There's that mindfulness word again, and we've really needed something here on systems theory, so be sure to join us. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.